welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting programs from the golden age of radio. I'm your host, Mark Levenier. In this hour, Adventure, later on Suspense from 1957, but first, Strange Wills. From January 10th, 1947, the story called Treasure to Starboard.
Strange Wills. Stories of strange wills made by strange people, starring the distinguished Hollywood actor Warren William, and featuring Loreen Tuttle, Perry Ward, with Howard Culver and an all-star Hollywood cast, and the original music of Del Castillo. I devise and bequeath to my heirs the seven deadly sins: hate, jealousy, anger, revenge, envy, greed, and lust. And here is our distinguished star of radio, screen, and stage, Warren William.
Strange wills are stories of strange and unusual testaments, many of which, when read between the lines, bring to light stories of dramatic intensity that defy our imagination. Names, places, and time have all been changed, so that no reflection can fall on any person or persons, living or dead. The masterpieces of fiction pale in comparison to the stark drama found in man's last official act on earth, his last will and testament. You'll see what I mean in just a moment, but first, let's listen to a few words from your announcer.
And now back to Warren William as John Francis O'Connell in Treasure to Starboard.
This is a story of sunken treasure, of blood-red rubies, sparkling diamonds, and lustrous pearls. But these were but a part of this priceless treasure trove. There were golden statues of pagan gods encrusted with precious stones. There were amethysts, opals, and gold. 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 On the night of March 12th, in the year 1703, some 400 miles off the coast of the West Indies, the Spanish three-master Toledo was foundering in the grip of a tremendous hurricane. In his cabin, Captain Fernandez was hurriedly drafting his last will and testament. He and his crew knew that death rode the gigantic waves and that hope of survival was an improbability.
I consign my body to the elements, and my soul to the loving and tender arms of the Holy Mother, and to some valiant adventurer whose heart beats with a lust of a Midas, I give the treasure on board my ship. Our position is longitude oeste.
We're about to abandon the ship, Captain. Hurry, hurry!
No, Jose, I shall stay. Go, all of you, and may heaven protect you.
For over 200 years, men have been searching for the treasure aboard the Toledo, but not one clue was ever found until one afternoon, a young, dashing, seafaring friend of mine, Captain Paul London, called me from some little island in the West Indies.
I can't tell you more than that, John. I'm afraid of eavesdroppers. But I know I'm on the right track. Now, I'll do just as I say, and I'll expect you both here next Sunday. So long, John.
So Paul had discovered a clue to the treasure ship Toledo.
Phew.
It had me excited. I could see quarts of rubies, pecks of diamonds, Well, who wouldn't get excited? I lost no time in contacting the person whose name he had given me. A certain Jean Medford.
Hello?
I'd like to speak to Mr. Jean Medford, please.
The name is right, but the sex is wrong, mister.
What do you mean?
I happen to be a female, a girl one, and a rather pretty one, too.
Oh, I'm sorry, Miss Medford. I had no idea when I talked with Paul...
Have you?
Less than 10 minutes ago. He called me from some little town called Rosarita.
Oh, and just what has the traveling Mr. London got up his sleeve today? And by the way, I'd like to know who I'm talking to.
Of course, I'm sorry. I'm John Francis O'Connell, attorney at law, and a personal friend of our mutual friend.
Oh, well, that's better. Now then, Mr. O'Connell, what does the great Paul want this time?
It's quite a large order, my lady. He wants you to prepare and pack a great deal of special equipment. Now, let's see. Where's the list he gave me? Oh, here it is. Your filtered ultraviolet light machine. A quantity of hydrothiocyanic acid. Well, all the materials and gadgets one uses in the examination of questioned documents.
And after I've done all that, then what do I do, please?
Then, my dear Miss Medford, I am to take you to the airport and fly you bodily to the lair of Paul London.
Why, that's ridiculous. I simply won't be led off by the nose in any wild goose chase of his. No, I refuse. I won't go.
Paul is on the trail of a buried treasure, Miss Medford. And I can guarantee you that if you're a good girl and come peacefully, that perhaps before this is over, you can wear rubies on your nightgown and dissolve real pearls in your bath.
Rubies on my nightgown and pearls in my bath? When do we start?
Tomorrow night. I'll pick you up about 5, and then we're off to high adventure. Fasten your seatbelt, Jean. We're over Rosarita, and I don't know what kind of a field this is going to be.
Oh, gee, I'm excited. Take it easy now. No crash landing. My nerves are on edge.
So are mine. Hang on, we're going down.
I'm ready.
I found this little nautical museum here quite by accident, and I ran across something that made my hair stand on end. In one of the exhibits, I found 2 pieces of evidence that sent me to the telephone and my call to John.
Well, for heaven's sake, don't keep us in suspense any longer, Paul. What's in this exhibit that makes you think you know where the Toledo lies?
Wait, John. Talk in a whisper. There are some strange-looking characters on the loose in this country. We can't be too careful. If this news ever got around...
Looking for an alibi already, Paul?
No, of course not. I'll tell you what I found. I found the water-soaked log of the Toledo. Every word has been washed out by seawater except the ship's name carved on the cover.
Ah, I'm beginning to see the light, and Jean here with all her paraphernalia.
That's right. Modern science will let us read that log. And if the captain of the Toledo lived up to the code of the sea...
We will find the position of his ship when she went down.
Well, so far, so good. Huh. But how does Paul intend to get the log?
You'll leave that to my gentle but persuasive administrations. The main thing is this. I'm going to get possession of the log of the Toledo for one night only. Jean, I want you to set up your apparatus here in this hotel room and wait until I return.
Well, how about me, Skipper? Need any help?
No, John, I think I can handle this alone. Remember now, I'll be back in 2 hours. Have everything ready.
And supposing the handsome male lead shouldn't come back?
Well, in that event, simply fold your tent like the Arabs.
And silently steal away.
Right.
Jean worked feverishly the next hour, getting her chemicals and equipment set up for this exciting moment. And then, quite suddenly...
Will you see who it is, please, John? Don't let anyone come in.
Very well. Paul! Good heavens, you're wounded. Here, let me help you.
Paul! Oh, Paul, what happened? The log, did you...
I'm all right. Got hit in the shoulder, but I've got it. Look.
Oh, here, give it to me. John, help Paul get his shirt off. I'll get some antiseptic.
Sit down on the bed, Paul. Here. I'll rip this shirt off your shoulder. Easy now.
It's just a flesh wound, John. Don't worry about it. What worries me is the man who took the shot at me.
Did you recognize him?
No, and I got a good look at his face, too. He was blonde, solid, had a German face.
You don't imagine someone else?
Well, I don't know, John, but there's that chance that someone else is as smart as I.
Bragging again, huh? Here, now, let me see that wound. Well, no bone smashed. It could have been worse. Hold still while I wash it.
Oh.
sissy. Now, hold still. Now, bandage. And in 2 minutes, I'll have you ready to lick your weight in wildcats.
The way I feel just now, those wildcats would have to be about 2 days old.
Jean worked far into the night and without success. Her ultraviolet light proved valueless. Photographs taken of the pages with infrared brought only blank negatives. All of us were frantic. Towards dawn, Jean looked up from her work.
Gentlemen, I think I'm a flop. I can't bring out a single word that's ever been written on this paper. It's hopeless, I guess. Oh, Paul. I feel terrible about letting you down.
Never mind, Jean. Don't feel too badly.
Wait. Wait a minute. Here. There's one more chance. John, get me a handful of soot out of the fireplace. Put it in this dish for me.
One handful of soot coming up.
Thank you. Now, John, come over to the table with me. Paul, you lie there and rest.
Okay, Duchess.
I'm going to plug in this special ray lamp. It throws a pinhole light. It must be parallel to the page in the log. If there's one single solitary indentation left, it'll bring it out. Now then, Mr. Barrister, out with the lights. I'll take a page at random for our experiment. Hand me the soot, please.
One order of soot. Over, easy.
You can't see this, Paul, but I'm blowing a pinch of soot over the page. Just a very fine coating. It'll work its way into any depression on the page. Now I'm letting the pinhole of light traverse across the page.
Look, Jean. I see a part of a letter forming. It makes a distinct shadow under the light. It's working. It's working.
Take it easy. It's too early to crow.
Say, if you think I'm going to lie here on the bed while you two solve the mystery of the log of the Toledo, you're both nuts.
It is working. Look, look. There's an S. A, Y. Oh, good. Now I'm going over to the back of the book and work forward. We've got to find the final entry. More soot, please. Lots more.
Page after page. Page after page. Our faces were drawn and haggard. And then...
Here it is. I've raised some more shadows. Oh, Paul, John. We found the last page of the log. The next few minutes will tell the story.
It looks like a number. It is. It's a six and a two after it. 62. That must be longitude. Yes, of course, longitude, 62 degrees.
Here comes the rest. What is it, Jean?
It looks like a one. I can't be sure. And the next number is...
You will remain seated, please. Carlos, turn on the light.
Si, mi comandante.
If you would avoid personal danger, you will not attempt to interfere. You see, I am armed. Good. Now then, permit me to introduce myself. I am Herr Gustav Richter, late U-boat commander in the German Navy.
Well, were we supposed to say Heil Hitler?
The war is over, the big one. But unless you leave this island immediately, a new one will start. Because, as you might know, we are both after the same thing. Now then, Carlos, you will take the book from the young lady's hands.
Si, senor.
Fräulein, the last number you are trying so hard to read. Maybe it's best if you don't find it. It will save us all a lot of trouble.
Aquí, comandante, the book.
Herr Richter, there are international rules of law governing...
Quiet! There are also local laws providing against breaking into and stealing public documents. I warn you most seriously. The treasure of the Toledo will be mine, and mine alone. If you should be foolish enough to interfere, I don't have to tell you what will happen. Thank you, and good night.
Well, of all the crazy...
Take it easy, Paul. He looks like he might be serious. Evidently, you weren't the only one who found the clue to the lost Toledo.
I can see those rubies on my nightgown walking right out of the window. And those pearls in my bath. I knew it sounded too good.
Not yet, Jean. I think that Herr Gustav Richter, late commander of the German Navy, is going to have some rough sailing ahead before he finds the sunken treasure. And by everything that's holy, we three are going to give it to him.
Part two of Strange Wills will continue in just a moment.
Thank you.
And now back to Warren William and Treasure to Starboard.
For the next 3 days, the cables between our island home and New York were kept exceptionally busy. Before the end of the week, huge quantities of deep-sea diving gear were being flown into Rosarita. We tried to trace our German friend, but he couldn't be found. I felt certain that we'd meet Herr Richter again, but I hoped we'd be more than ready for him. About 2 weeks later, when the last of our equipment was delivered, we called a meeting of our augmented crew, who were hired to man our ship. Some of them were imported from the States. They wore campaign ribbons and, well, you know our sailors.
And we've got to be prepared for everything. Our ship is a floating arsenal as well as a scientific laboratory. Our treasure prize is high, and every one of us will share it if we find it. Are you ready?
You bet we are, sir. Yes, sir.
Okay, then. We'll leave port in an hour. I'll see you all on board.
In the captain's quarters aboard our ship, Paul, Jean, and I had another meeting.
I've got it all figured out to almost a mathematical certainty. I can bring this ship within 10 miles of where the Toledo went down. The rest is pure luck.
Do you think the Jerrys know we sailed, Paul?
That I don't know, but the word will get back to Herr Richter. Don't you worry. Maybe he's already on the way. But so what?
How's he going to get there?
Maybe he has a ship. Maybe he can use his sub. I don't know that. But getting there and staying there are going to be two different things. He'll find out.
We spent 2 quiet, uneventful days sailing to our destination. If it hadn't been for the tenseness on board, I could have had a lovely time. But with diamonds, rubies, and buried treasure, and a battle in the offing, well, how could anyone hope to rest? Near the end of the second day...
Come in.
Just picked up this message, sir. It's from the SS Juniper, bound for Boston.
Thank you.
SS Juniper reports sighting a strange submarine at 14 o'clock. Craft heading northeast by east. Refused to reply to radiogram. May possibly be an escaped Nazi sub. Be alert. Huh. Well, there's our answer. Herr Richter's on the way. We better be ready tomorrow when we meet him on the floor of the ocean.
We arrived at our calculated position sometime during the light and lay to. No sooner had we dropped our anchors than the crew took to the boats and began sounding operations to determine the depth of the water around us. They reported just at dawn.
Average depth from 30 to 90 fathoms, sir. We found a sharp decline about a quarter mile east. We were unable to reach bottom at that point, but our charts show this to be a part of the Great Fissure, one of the deepest points in the entire Atlantic.
Thanks, Pete. Tell the first mate that I'll go down as soon as I've had breakfast. Tell him to have the gear ready.
Aye, aye, sir.
After breakfast, Paul donned his gear and went over the side. Jean and I stood by the air pump and wondered what would happen below. Was the sub lying there? Would they locate the rotting hull of the Toledo? Would they find the treasure before us? These were anxious moments. Paul kept in constant touch through our sea phone.
Paul? Paul, can you hear me?
Still going down. Getting darker. Turning on my pressure light. Now on bottom.
Oh, John, so far so good.
Yes, Jean, so far so good.
A wreck ahead, not our ship, has 2 stacks. Circling to avoid fouling airline. Reach the edge of the outer fissure. We'll follow it. Water beyond fissure very black. Very deep. Try not to slip.
Oh, Paul, darling, don't talk like that or I'll make you come right up.
I'll be careful, sweetheart. Just past a shark. He sends his regards to Johnny Weismuller.
We'll see that he doesn't send you along for a greeting card.
Oh, I see a wreck on the edge of the great fissure. An old one, covered with sand. Send down sand gun on rope.
It's coming right down, darling. Quick, he wants a sand gun sent down to him. It's on the way, Paul. Be careful now.
Going to blow a little sand away to see if I can discover the identity of the ship.
John. John, come here, please. Listen. Listen to the phone. Do you hear anything?
Let me listen. Paul.
Paul, this is John. Listen. Come up at once. The sub is in the vicinity. We've just picked up the sound vibrations. Hurry, man. Hurry.
I feel it too, John. Just a minute more. I'm getting a piece off this old hull. I'll bring it up. Okay, I've got it. Race away.
Start the winch. She's coming up. Hurry. Three minutes of maddening delay, and then I saw his helmet break water. As busy hands unbolted his helmet, he gave us a little net, which he held in his hand. We took it eagerly, and there it was. A piece of old, decayed wood. But on it was a small brass plate, some old, rusted fitting that had seen the ocean bottom for many a year. I gave it to Jean, and she hurried to the laboratory to take off the corrosion. Naturally, I hurried with her.
It's coming off. I can almost make it out, John. Let me see. There's an L, an O, T. Here it is, Toledo. The Toledo. We've found it. We've found it. Oh, John, I'm so happy. Let's hurry and tell Paul.
After Paul came out of the decompression chamber, he told us his story.
He's lying at the very edge of the fissure. We must be very careful, or it's possible that it may disappear entirely. There are tons of sand to be blown out, and then, well, then we'll know the answer.
But what about the sub, Paul? Good heavens, you don't mean to start blowing out sand with a mad German sitting alongside of you.
We have to take that chance. I think we're better equipped, and if we work fast, we can be out of here in 2 days. Even before he finds out where the Toledo is lying. Right now, we have to float a buoy over the spot and pull out of here. Maybe we can throw them off the track. We'll come back later and then go to work.
Under the cover of darkness, we crept back to our position. Paul and two divers went over the side to begin the hazardous task of uncovering the ship. We agreed on complete silence, unless an emergency arose. I'll never forget how long that night lasted. Along about midnight, our worst fears were realized. Jean, the sub is on the prowl. Listen.
We've got to let him know. We've got to warn him.
Yes, tell him.
Paul? Can you hear me? Paul?
Can't stop the talk now. We're inside ship. There are uncovered iron chests. Hold on.
He won't listen, John. He won't. Wait a minute. John. I can't hear the sub. It stopped.
Probably gone out of range.
Treasure to starboard. Treasure to starboard. We found the treasure of the Toledo.
Did you hear, John? They found it. They found the treasure of the Toledo. Paul? Paul, answer me. Paul? Oh, John, something's gone wrong. The line's dead. Paul, answer. Are you all right? Paul? Paul?
Five interminable minutes dragged by on leaden feet. Not a sound came from Paul or from the divers down there with him. What had happened? How could we know? Then...
They came out of the escape hatch. They're surrounding...
Take this phone, John. Don't stop listening for a moment.
Jean ran the length of the ship and disappeared. Paul's position was most precarious. We couldn't drop a depth charge. We couldn't do anything to help. I kept trying to reach Paul on the phone, but the line was apparently dead. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw a diving helmet disappear over the side of our ship. I looked round for Jean. She was gone. And then I realized, too late, that she... I gave the earphones to a sailor and ran down the deck. Who was that? Went over the side just now.
That was Miss Medford, sir. She insisted on going down.
You fool! Why did you let her do that?
Well, she said she was the only one who knew how to detonate the underwater bomb, sir.
So that was it. Little Jean Medford going down to lick the sub crew single-handed. What a fool. What a brave, glorious little fool. I prayed as I had never prayed before. Everyone aboard leaned over the side of the ship, silently looking down into the dark blue of the water. What was happening down there? Then, 200 yards off our stern, we saw an oil slick spread on the surface. She'd done it. She destroyed the sub. And what of the crew? It was either surrender or death. Later, Paul told us the story.
We saw them coming at us just after we'd uncovered the treasure. They had special equipment, compressed air helmets without airlines attached. They held long steel pikes in their hands. In the glow of our lights, we could see the outline of the sub. I thought sure it was curtains, till I saw someone sneak up to the sub and drop something down the escape hatch. The explosion knocked us all flat. Then I looked around. I saw the sub roll on its side, and the Toledo, well, she had entirely disappeared. The blast had sent it tumbling down the fissure. The treasure went with it.
And the Germans?
For all I know, they're still walking back to land.
And so ended the quest for treasure to starboard. Jean didn't get her rubies and pearls after all, but she's still very well satisfied, because shortly after we returned to the States...
And do you, Jean Medford, take this man to be your lawful wedded husband through sickness and in health, for richer or for poorer, until death do you part?
I do.
Then by virtue of the authority vested in me, I pronounce you man and wife.
Darling.
Well, I did manage to get one diamond anyway, didn't I, dearest?
Warren William will be back in just a moment to tell you more about Treasure to Starboard. But first, here is a word from your announcer. And here again is Warren William.
Little did Captain Fernandez realize as he wrote his last will and testament in the ship's log on the night of March 12, 1703, that over 200 years later, men would still fight and die to recover the treasure that went down with him to the bottom of the sea. Will the treasure of the Toledo ever be relocated? Well, it depends on science and the brave daring of intrepid adventurers. We've managed to reach the straitest sphere. Why not the unknown depths of the sea? Especially when it holds not one, but hundreds of treasures of inestimable value. Who will risk their lives to recover them? Will you? Next week, I'm going to tell you the story about a professor who believed that heredity is stronger than environment. Unfortunately, he put his nefarious belief to an actual test that involved the life of an innocent child. In order to prove his point to a doubting scientific world, the professor married a woman in whose veins coursed criminal blood for many generations. From this unholy union, a child was born, to be reared as a lady. But from the very first, strange signs of bad blood cropped up in the child. What happened to her? Well, listen next week to the story we call One Shining Hour. This is Warren William inviting you to listen again next week.
Strange Wills is written by Ken Crepin and directed by Albert Ulrich. This is a Tellaways feature produced in Hollywood.
Strange Wills, on Tuned to Yesterday, a syndicated recording from January 10th, 1947. You're listening to an hour of adventure on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Now time for radio's outstanding theater of thrills, Suspense, which brings us an adventure story with a conductor and composer in the lead, a man by the name of Ray Noble. William N. Robeson, the director of Suspense at the time, gives him a nice introduction, and he must have enjoyed his dramatic role on the series because about a year later, he returned to the series for the story Just One Happy Little Family, making his last appearance on radio during its golden era. Suspense next with the story The Star of Thessaly from November 24, 1957 on CBS.
Suspense. And the producer of radio's outstanding theater of thrills, the master of mystery and adventure, William N. Robeson.
Recognize that melody? Of course you do. How many countless happy dancing evenings have come to a close with Good Night, Sweetheart? But for $64,000, do you know who wrote it? And what, you might well ask, has all this to do with suspense? Well, it's a tuneful way to introduce the star of the upcoming story, Ray Noble. That's right, Ray Noble, who wrote Good Night, Sweetheart. For years, along with everybody else, we have thought Ray Noble was a very funny fellow as he bandied his egg-headed wit against the wooden-headed quips of Charlie McCarthy and Mortimer Snerd on the Edgar Bergen Show. So when Mr. Noble came back from London for a short holiday in Hollywood, we wrote a play for him and persuaded him to essay his first dramatic role. Listen, listen then, as Ray Noble stars in The Star of Thessaly.
And now, Mr. Ray Noble starring in The Star of Thessaly, a tale well calculated to keep you in suspense.
The adventure began under the classic circumstances dear to the hearts of the writers of British short stories, and presumably their readers. That is to say, it was a foggy November night in London, and a group of us were gathered before the crackling fire in St. Botolph's Club in the West End. There were, as I remember, Sir Eustace Twining, Christopher Wrexham, Colonel Thorndike, just home from India, and one other. Now, who could that have been? Oh, yes, it was I. Captain Anthony Chumley-Smythe, OBE, DSC, recently retired and presently unemployed.
Dreary weather.
Beastly.
Monstrous. Absolutely monstrous.
Oh, it's not quite that bad, Sir Eustace.
The vulgarity of it. The sheer downright vulgarity.
Who?
This bounder here in the Times.
What bounder?
This bounder. Just listen to this personal notice on the front page. For hire. Retired Captain Queen's Hussars, Oxonian, superior intelligence, superb family connections, will go anywhere and do anything for a price, reply box 322, etc. Gentlemen, what is England coming to?
Sounds like a rather enterprising chap.
Enterprising? He's a traitor to his class, sir. Offering his services like an ordinary domestic.
Oh, it pays to advertise, Sir Eustace.
Really, Chumley, is there nothing sacred? To parade one's college, one's family, to flaunt one's military service?
Here, here.
Oh, I don't know. As a matter of fact, I'd like to have a talk with this chap.
Oh, really?
Yes. My company has a most delicate situation on its hands. The kind of thing we can't entrust to the ordinary detective type. It requires tact, diplomacy, and all that.
Do go on, old boy.
Well, it involves the Star of Thessaly.
And what might that be?
Oh, a diamond which our company has insured for £250,000.
I say.
Well, it's worth much more, of course, though you'd never know it. It looks like a big pebble that one might find on the beach at Brighton. Uncut, you know.
Oh, why?
Well, the owner, Socrates Melas, is not only one of the wealthiest men in Greece, but he's also one of the most eccentric. He carries the Star of Thessaly on his person as a pocket piece. Of course, we run no great risk on the diamond so long as Mr. Melas remains in bed.
In bed?
Oh, yes, yes, he's an invalid. And his villa in Athens is quite competently protected by the local police. However, it has become necessary for him to travel to Paris for an operation, and the old boy insists on carrying the diamond with him. I need somebody just like your advertising friend, so you assist.
No friend of mine, sir.
Somebody suave enough to try to dissuade Mr. Melas from taking the diamond with him on the trip. And failing that, someone resourceful enough to go along on the trip and see that it isn't stolen.
That's quite an assignment.
Yes, but remunerative. What box number did that chap mention in the Times, Sir Eustace?
Oh, box 322. But no need to contact him there, Wrexham. As they say in the American cinema, you've just got yourself a boy.
What? Are you saying, sir, that you inserted this notice?
Quite right, Sir Eustace.
Shame, shame.
Gad, sir, it's worse than going into trade.
Oh, but much more profitable and infinitely more exciting, what? Thirty-six hours later, I presented myself at Socrates Melas' villa on Mount Lycabettus overlooking Athens. A mustachioed guard in a white pleated ballet skirt showed me into the old man's room. It was like a museum with a bed. Around the walls were ancient figurines of marble and terracotta and whatnot, and in the bed was a mummy, dried and wrinkled and yellow. Since it moved and spoke, I assumed it must be Socrates Melas himself, And so it was.
I know why you have come here, and I wish you would go away.
I will, sir, as soon as you have agreed to place the Star of Thessaly in a safe deposit box.
The Star is my talisman. I am never without it.
Look, Mr. Melas, it's not only unwise, it's actually dangerous to go traveling around Europe with 250,000 quid in your pocket.
Oh, nonsense. Nonsense, I say. The Star is only a piece of crystallized carbon. Look at it. It's just a little rock.
Yes, sir, but a highly publicized little rock. You must leave it behind.
Never! I like the feel of it. I like to know that it's in my pocket. I am never without it.
Very well, then. I'm afraid you'll never be without me until I can deliver you safely in Paris.
Senseless idiocy. I have a nurse to take care of me.
Nursing schools don't teach the kind of care I'm speaking of.
So, I can't rid myself of you, eh?
No, sir, not unless you put the Star of Thessaly in a safe place while you're away.
Very well. We leave tonight at 10 o'clock. What is your name?
Captain Anthony Cholmondeley Smythe.
Did you ring, sir?
Did I ring? Yes! This is Captain Smythe. He's traveling to Paris with us. His name is Hippolyte.
Oh, how do you do?
Delightfully.
Huh?
Make reservations for him on the same car as ours.
Yes, sir.
All right, Captain Smythe. I don't think we have anything further to discuss.
No, sir, I suppose not.
Show Captain Smythe out, Hippolyte.
Yes, sir. This way, please.
I'll see you on the train, Mr. Melas.
I hope not.
Huh. Your employer seems to be a man of pretty strong likes and dislikes.
He's more than that, Captain. He's selfish, ungrateful, and downright mean. I've given him the best years of my life, and I don't even have his thanks to show for it.
Crying shame, isn't it?
I tell you, Captain Smythe, it is the end.
Well, I'm awfully... Hey, wait a minute. Out there in the garden. I say, what an exquisite creature.
Oh, her. That's Kula.
Is she his nurse?
Good heavens, no. Kula's his granddaughter. I am his nurse.
Later that afternoon, with time on my hands, I wandered up to the Acropolis to pay my respects to the ruins of ancient Athens. And there, as the setting sun streamed through the columns of the Parthenon, I discovered I wasn't alone on the hilltop. Leaning against one of the pillars was a beautiful, dark-haired girl whom I was sure I knew. If I didn't, I certainly wanted to. I beg your pardon, but haven't
we... Excuse me?
I have a feeling we've met somewhere before.
I think not, sir.
Oh, then may I correct that lamentable situation? I'm Captain Anthony Cholmondeley Smythe.
I'm glad to meet you, sir. I'm Kula...
Melas?
Yes. How did you know?
That's where I saw you. You see, this afternoon I visited your grandfather and I saw you in the garden as I was leaving.
Oh.
Yes, I wanted so to meet you, but your grandfather's nurse ushered me right out of the house.
Oh, that Hippolyte, that nasty little man.
Absolutely, to say the least. And what, may I ask, brings you up to the Acropolis all alone?
Oh, I come here often at the end of the day. It is so beautiful.
It certainly is. Oh, wait a minute.
What is it?
I thought I saw a man's head peering down at us from up there on the roof of the Parthenon.
Oh, you must be mistaken.
No.
The twilight, it was probably a bird or your imagination.
Perhaps so. It is getting dark. But what say we go back down the hill and have a cocktail?
Oh, I'm afraid I can't. I must go home and finish my packing.
Oh, packing?
Yes, I'm leaving for Paris tonight.
With your grandfather?
Yes.
Oh, wizard! Utterly smashing.
I beg your pardon.
Well, I'm going to be on the same train, in the same car, in fact.
How nice.
So, if I may, I'd like to see you.
Captain, look out! What was that?
A large marble fragment of ancient Greece. If I hadn't taken your arm just then, it would have splattered me all over the Acropolis.
But who could have done
it? Your bird, or that man I imagined I saw up there on the roof. Come on, let's get out of here. Unlike Lord Byron, I have no desire to be buried in the Isles of Greece. At 9:45 that night, a curious procession entered the train shed of the Athens railway station. It was headed by Socrates Melas in a wheelchair, pushed by a perspiring Hippolyte. After them, the lovely Kula, and bringing up the rear, yours truly, carrying his own bags. The old man ignored me, the male nurse virtually snubbed me, but this didn't concern me too much as soon as I caught up with Kula. Good evening.
Oh, Captain, I thought perhaps you had changed your mind.
Oh, about taking this train? Dear goddess, once I learned you were to be a fellow passenger, Hercules himself could have
defied... Captain, look out!
She yanked me to one side as a huge porter pushing a heavy cart of luggage grazed by me and shoved on through the crowd without a by your leave. Following him was a short, hatless, bull-necked man, evidently the owner of the cart full of luggage.
Oh, such a careless fellow.
If you hadn't pulled me aside, you'd have broken my legs with that truck.
That would have been a regrettable accident.
I don't think it would have been an accident. Ah, here we are, the Paris car.
You know, that's curious.
What?
Do you see that man tipping the porter?
Oh, my hit-and-run porter, yeah.
I think I have seen him someplace before, just today.
Seeing that one twice in one day is once too many.
Now I remember. He was up on the Acropolis earlier this afternoon before you arrived.
Oh, he was. And I dare say he was still there after we left.
What do you mean?
I'll tell you when I'm certain.
En voiture! En voiture!
There was a pattern here, and it was beginning to emerge. The bull-necked man with the hit-and-run porter had also been on the Acropolis shortly before that chunk of Greece's glory had scored a near miss on my skull. And now he was traveling in the same car with me. It was all very well to be Socrates Milas' bodyguard, but at that moment I would have liked very much to have a bodyguard for myself. But things looked better in the morning, as our through car joined the Orient Express at Salonika. The bull-necked man hadn't emerged from his compartment, and what disturbed me more, neither had Kula. So I breakfasted alone. And then as the train sped west towards Italy and the Alps, I went forward to pay my respects to the boss.
Yes? Oh, Captain Smythe.
How's Mr. Malus today?
Quite well.
Who is that, Hippolyte?
Captain Smythe.
Send him away.
Oh, come now, old chap. I'm not here by choice, you know. How are you feeling?
Very well. Why shouldn't I be?
Everything all right?
Certainly. The Star of Thessaly is right here in my pajama pocket, if that's what you mean.
Good. That's what I mean. The next day and a half were dull. Oh, very dull. Kula remained in her compartment pleading a migraine. The bullet-headed bull-necked man stayed in his, for reasons best known to himself, so I stayed in mine, except for meals and the periodic and unwelcome checkups I made every few hours on the whereabouts of the Star of Thessaly. Then on the afternoon of the second day, while the train was snaking upwards through the Italian Alps, I was idly leafing through some magazines I'd picked up in the Milan station when the train attendant came in.
Scusa, signore.
What do you want?
Well, we come subito to Simplon Tunnel. I'm going to turn on the lights.
Oh, the Simplon Tunnel.
Yes, si, signore. The longest tunnel in the world. 12 miles all uphill. She start in Italia and she come out in Switzerland.
My, my. Well, thanks for the travelogue.
Che, signor?
Nothing, just thanks.
Oh, prego, prego, signor.
A moment later, the Orient Express was swallowed up by the Simplon Tunnel. A moment after that, the door of my compartment slid open again. And there stood my bullet-headed bull-neck neighbor pointing a very efficient German Luger at me.
Now, Captain Smythe, you will get down to business.
Who are you?
It's of no importance.
And what is the business we're going to get down to?
The business of you leaving the train right now.
Oh, come now. It's dark out there in the tunnel.
Lower that window.
Well, and let all the smoke in.
Lower it or...
all right, don't get so excited. There. See? Smoke. Very annoying.
Now, out of the window. Raus!
Look, before I do, would you mind telling me why?
You are in my way.
I beg your pardon?
Before this train emerges from the tunnel, I intend to have the Star of Thessaly.
Oh, I see. You weren't by any chance crawling around the roof of the Parthenon the other night, were you?
Of course.
And of course you paid the porter to try and run me down to the railway station?
Of course, and each time that girl saved you. But nothing can save you now. Out of the window with you.
While I had kept him talking, the compartment had been filling with train smoke. I'd been calculating the lurch of the car. Now I turned towards the window slowly, waiting for the car to lurch once more. I braced myself at the window. The car gave a jerk, throwing bull-neck slightly off balance. I whirled, grabbed his gun arm, thrust my knee into his middle and rolled over. Unfortunately, the train lurched a little more than I expected, and poor old bull-neck kept going right on through that window. I tore out of my compartment and down the corridor to Melas's room. The light was out. If a light wasn't there, the old man was lying on the bed, breathing shadowly, obviously doped. I felt in his pajama pocket and I felt around the bedclothes. It was nowhere, it was gone. The Star of Thessaly was gone.
In just a moment, we continue with the third act of Suspense.
Memo on Metals
information about our military awards and decorations. The awarding of American medals had its beginning during the Revolutionary War. Certain military and naval commanders were presented gold medals to commemorate their victories. The first medal in our nation's history was given to General George Washington after he had forced the British to evacuate Boston. That medal is now in the Boston Public Library, where it was placed on exhibit in 1876, 100 years after the historic event it commemorates. Technically, early medals were not decorations in the strictest sense. They honored both a victorious event and the officer in charge. Also, they were not designed to be worn, as later medals were. Therefore, they were presented in a suitable case for safekeeping. What we now know as the Purple Heart Medal was originally a badge of cloth material, specified in Washington's establishing order to be a figure of a heart in purple cloth or silk, edged with narrow lace or binding. Foreign decorations and medals are worn to the left of all American decorations. They are never worn alone, but must appear with at least one American medal. Few tributes are as meaningful and as cherished as the awards and decorations of our armed forces.
And now, starring Ray Noble, Act 3 of The Star of Thessaly. The Star of Thessaly was gone, and the man who had planned to steal it was gone too. Who else was after it then? Of course, there wasn't much time. I sent Cooler in to look after her grandfather, and I started to search the car, compartment by compartment. By the time I was halfway through, the train was out of the tunnel and slowing down for Swiss customs inspection. I heard a door open at the forward end and saw a figure slip out of the WC. It was Hippolyte. He threw open the vestibule door and dropped off the train, stumbling as he hit the gravel of the roadbed. I jumped after him, but he was on his feet and running, his left leg limping badly. I nearly caught up with him when he turned suddenly. I saw the gun in his hand and dived in a flying tackle as it went up. All right, hippie old boy. I want two things from you. That gun.
Please, please let me go, Captain.
And the Star of Thessaly.
Let me keep it, Captain Smythe. He does not need it. He has millions. Let me keep the star.
You know that it would probably kill him to lose that diamond.
It is only a pocket piece to him. He owes it to me. I've given him the best years of my life. Let me keep this star, Captain Smythe. Please let me escape.
Come on, Happy. Crying will get you nowhere.
You are just a heartless brute, Captain Smythe.
Yeah, I know. But let's go, sport.
Where have you been? I've been so worried.
Is he still asleep?
Yes, he hasn't moved.
Good.
What are you doing?
Putting the Star of Thessaly back in his pocket. It was misplaced for a little while. Oh, and Cooler, I'm afraid you'll have to take over as your grandfather's nurse.
Why? Where is Hippolyte?
Well, he fell in love with the Alps, so he's stopping over for a while in Switzerland.
Dreadful weather.
Beastly.
Hello, evening, chaps.
Evening, Chumley.
Well, aren't you going to ask me about my trip?
Trip? You've been away?
Yes, I
thought I hadn't seen you about for a few days. Dreadful weather we're having, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Beastly. Suspense. In which Ray Noble starred in The Star of Thessaly, written, directed, and produced by William N. Robeson. Supporting Mr. Noble in The Star of Thessaly were Lillian Bayef, Ben Wright, Jay Novello, Byron Kane, and Abraham Sofair. Listen.
Listen again next week when we return with another tale well calculated to keep you in suspense.
Suspense has been brought to you through the worldwide facilities of the United States Armed Forces Radio and Television Service.
Suspense, on Tuned to Yesterday from the 24th of November, 1957 on CBS. And so closes this hour of adventure on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. It's been a pleasure.